Hi, I'm Charlotte.
And I'm Lauren. Our pronouns are she, her.
This is D-Myth Turns the Page.
Our special episodes where we look after our family.
We travel to the ends of the earth.
And we speak to Lauren J.A. Bear about her book, Medusa's Sisters. So hi, Lauren, and thank you so much for joining us. Judging from your book, I think we're going to be like best friends now. And were you a mythology kid growing up like we were?
I totally was. In third grade, we did the very, you know, the Disney overview in class of who the gods and goddesses were. And it is prime material for little kids because it's like superheroes, right? Everyone has a special power. Everyone's so good looking. Like, it's just so attractive to young people. The irony of this, of course, is that the actual material is not appropriate for young people, but you're getting such a, you know, washed down version of it when you're young. So my dad went out and bought me Edith Hamilton's Mythology in third grade, and I read it, which I think is why I am the way I am, because I read these real stories, you know, in my formative years.
And just for the British here, third grade is how
like
old?
8 years old.
Oh, wow, that's quite young.
Yes, it's way too young. But here I am. So thanks, Dad. I guess it worked out okay.
Before we get started, please tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so obviously I'm Lauren J. Bear. I have two middle names. And I live in Seattle, Washington now, but I was born in Boston and then I grew up in Long Beach, California. I was a middle school teacher. So that means, you know, like 10 through 14 years old for a long time, for over a decade. And I did teach this material as a humanities teacher before I then quit teaching to become a full-time writer. And I have three kids who are all under the age of 8. So I'm like basically insane most of the time from exhaustion and like extreme levels of caffeine.
Well, props to you for not only taking care of your own kids, but for a long time taking care of other people's, because I couldn't do it.
I don't know how you do it. I'm exhausted and running on caffeine without three children under the age of 8. So props to you. Well done.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, they're little mythology experts now.
Have you told them the unsanitized versions? Do they know the truth?
They do not know about the sexual assault of Medusa, which I'm sure we will get into today because it is such a pivotal moment in her journey and in her story. But I think they understand why their mom likes to write about bad guys. I was actually chatting with one of my kids about this. Like, why do you think the perspective of a bad guy matters? And one of my kids said, like, well, maybe if someone robbed you, but you found out why they needed to rob you, you know, you would understand. They were like, well, it would still be bad that they robbed you, but maybe it would be more understandable. I was like, exactly right, you guys. That's exactly why we write stories about bad guys or other people who are muted, misunderstood, maligned. It's an opportunity for compassion and to understand each other. And I really think that that's what I care about most in my work, is opportunities for us to understand each other.
Before we get into the actual story, we have to talk about your cover, which is so, so gorgeous. So who is your cover designer?
Julia Lloyd. Titan made the most beautiful version of this for the UK. I just think it's stunning. And the gold foil, it's so fancy. It's like a chocolate candy.
I think it fits with all of the retellings that we've been having coming out. Like, you can look at it and it fits so well into that genre. Did you have any input into the design, or did you just see it and were like, yes, I loved it?
Pretty much that. I'm not an artist. I won't claim to be an artist. You know, I stay in my lane, I guess. And I was just so appreciative. I mean, this whole experience, I think I'm just overwhelmed with gratitude. I've been so thankful for the professionals that are helping me on this journey. And yeah, the cover is so stunning.
Even before they were transformed into Gorgons, Medusa and her sisters, Steno and Eurele, were unique among immortals. Curious about mortals and their lives, Medusa and her sisters entered the human world in search of a place to belong, yet quickly found themselves at the perilous centre of a dangerous Olympian rivalry, and learned too late that a god's love is a violent one.
So to get into the actual story, I guess what was the inspiration for choosing Medusa's story, but having it be more about the people around her? Because that's not a perspective that we've seen. And we've had loads of amazing Medusa stories come out, but yours is so different.
Absolutely. When I was on, so as I mentioned, I taught humanities, which is, you know, a combination of literature and history, right, in the United States. And I was on maternity leave with my daughter. And so it's 2017, which was the Trump era in the United States. It was a dark time over here. And I'm on maternity leave with my daughter. And I think it must have been one of the last lessons I taught before I left to give birth was the ancient Greece unit. So it must have been in my brain somewhere, just kind of like percolating. But I'm up with her. It's like 3 in the morning. I'm so tired. But also, I don't know about you guys, but this is when sometimes I have like my best ideas or my best questions is in the middle of the night when you're sleep deprived. And I thought Medusa was a Gorgon. So that must mean there's other Gorgons. And I've been reading this material my whole life. I have no idea who they are. So my daughter's sleeping and I go on Wikipedia over her head, you know, like the professional scholar that I am. I Google Gorgon and there's a quote from Jane Ellen Harrison, who was a 19th century classical scholar. And she says, basically, the other two Gorgons don't matter. They are mere appendages to their famous sister. And I'm a woman. I'm holding my daughter. It's 2017. And I was just really overwhelmed by this. And overcome. And no woman is an appendage. No human being is an appendage. And I became kind of obsessed with finding out more about Steno and Eurele from there.
Do you think it's when you have a character like Medusa, you don't even need to know anything about Greek mythology. Like, you know who she is. Do you think that sort of hindered you or did it actually help you creatively? Because you've had to kind of create the character of her sisters almost, give them personality, give them wants and desires.
When I think of Medusa, I mean, before all of this, right, before my life became obsessed with Medusa, I think the two associations I had were like super sexual, like kind of like Britney Spears at the VMAs and the like the snake dancing kind of thing that people do with Medusa, or as a symbol of rage. And I didn't really want her to be either of those things. So my Medusa is... she's like a carpe diem girly, you know, she wants to live life as fully as she can. She's super curious. She's kind. I just wanted her to be different than what was going to be expected of her to be. There is rage, there's sex, but I gave those moments more to her sisters, to Steno and Eurele. And when the first decision I made actually with the sisters in creating their characters, like day one in my notebook was they have to look different than Medusa. And I don't know about you two, but when I think of Medusa, I think of, you know, the screaming face with all the green snakes, right? That's kind of the symbol of Medusa. So when I gave Steno and Eurele different colored snakes, different types of snakes, different numbers of snakes, honestly, their personalities kind of grew organically from there.
You start the book telling us the ending, as we mentioned before we started recording. And to quote from your book, our third was our center. And when we lost her, we also failed each other, collapsing inward upon ourselves. So I guess my question is, why did you start telling us the ending and acknowledging the ending and then going backwards? Is that because it's so famous and everybody knows it?
Yes, you nailed it. I felt like that's what everyone's waiting for, is for Medusa to lose her head. So let's cut her head off in the first chapter. And I really wanted that to be, I wanted to throw my reader off, really. I wanted it to be disconcerting, because if that's not the climax, then what else is coming for these sisters?
And what I really enjoyed was the line, after he took Medusa's head, Perseus threw up. And the comment kind of on the poets romanticizing the myth and the legend and not the actuality of it. And as a humanities teacher, do you think that's because history's written by the victors?
Absolutely. Anytime we retell a story, an old story, I see it as like an act of subversion. You know, it's transferring power away from the traditional storyteller, who traditionally is a white male, right? So we're like taking power back and changing the story. And then also with Perseus, the easy thing, I think, would have been to make him kind of an asshole, right? Like, he's the jock guy, he's the muscle guy, he's like kind of like alpha male aggro, that guy. And I actually had a lot of empathy for him as I was writing his story, that he is also a plaything of systems of power that manipulate him. So one of the things I read when I did a lot of research for this book, and I realized I had almost finished the draft, and I realized, oh my gosh, I don't know where her head ends up. Where does Medusa's head go? Like, I didn't know. And what I found in the primary source material is that Perseus buried it. And hearing that really made me reconsider who he is, because he didn't want that to be used as a weapon anymore. And he hid it away, he put it away, and it made me think differently about him. Like, maybe he's different than what I'm assuming he's going to be.
On the same page, Steno says, nobody requested our testimony. So this is talking about the fact that Perseus threw up. The voices of ugly women are easily diminished. So let's hear your TED talk on this, because I thought that line was, I thought it was really powerful. And it's kind of true.
It is kind of true. I mean, especially when you look at Greek mythology, for instance, the women that get any perspective, even like as limited as it is, fall into such archetypes, right? There's like the faithful wife, like Penelope. There's the, you know, raging sorceress, like Medea. And then there's like the sexy sex pot, Helen, right? And all of them are always beautiful. That is so boring. That is so inauthentic, right? Where are the real women in Greek mythology? And obviously real women we don't have snakes and wings, but those are the stories that I care about. Truth, whatever truth means, I think, is more likely found as you take into account as many perspectives as possible.
I think you can substitute like the wings and the snakes for hair for maybe a nose that someone feels is a bit too big, or someone feeling that their chest is too small or their thighs are too big. And it's, you can't do an exact swap for modern women, but there are things that we have that are seen as more undesirable, like snakes for hair and wings. So I think it's quite a relatable line for a lot of people that are going to be reading this, especially considering when you started coming up with the concept of it.
Thank you. That really means a lot to me. I hope so. I hope people feel seen, because so much about this book is about owning your story too. You know, what I think makes characters super interesting is when there's this disconnect between what the character thinks they want and what the character actually needs. And like for Steno, for example, what she thinks she wants is to take care of Medusa and to be that big sister and to protect her sisters. But what Steno actually needs is her own voice. And she needs to be able to tell her own story and be her own individual person. And I do feel like she achieves that at the end.
I do have a question about that in the spoiler section. So
okay.
We'll get to it.
And as someone who plays music, you would pick up on that more than I would. You're a mum, you've had three kids. Can we take a moment to mention the birth scene at the beginning? Because that was horrendous. So hopefully that didn't come from personal experience.
You know, it's funny. My book club read Medusa Sisters, which was really sweet and silly for me. But when we were talking about it, one of my girlfriends who's also had some wild labor and delivery stories was like, I loved when Medusa's like, I just want to die. Like, she's like, thank you for being honest, because that's what it feels like. And yeah, when Sito gives birth to the Gorgons as well, it's pretty graphic, because that's real. That's real talk. And there's obviously another scene, which we'll probably talk about in the spoiler section in the temple. But I really do feel like with some of these graphic situations that happen to these female characters in the story, of course, there's the option to do a dot, 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 fade to black and not show the gritty reality. I'm not always sure who that serves, though, you know, by not talking about it. And I think, obviously, the Me Too movement was huge in the States as I was writing this book, and I was thinking about that a lot, composing Medusa's story.
And the scene sees Sito disregarding Medusa at birth and Echidna saving her, bringing her back to her sisters. So is this from a myth that you found and that we haven't heard of, or did you reimagine that scene?
No, I made that up. And I think it's because one of the first quandaries I was kind of stuck in with writing this story is, how can triplets be born and one of them is mortal and the other two aren't? And so much of Greek mythology is like, you just have to suspend reason and rationality and just go with it. But I needed something more. So I had to create some kind of system for why that would work, which is why I had the, like, if you're born in the call or not in the call, it would indicate whether you were mortal or immortal. But also that idea that these triplets from the jump, from day one, are so unbalanced. Because how would it feel to be a part of a group and always know that one of you is going to die? And for Steno, that makes her super overprotective. It shapes her life, right? And then for Eurylee, she just feels very bitter and frustrated. And they're both right. And because of that, they both view Medusa very differently.
Throughout the book, you weave other myths and legends, which we obviously really appreciate. One such myth is that of Pandora, and the sisters are discussing Pandora amongst themselves. Eurylee says people shouldn't accept gifts from Zeus, and Steno asks her sisters if they would have opened the vase. You know, and herself, she's adamant she would not have opened the vase. Would you have opened the vase?
Probably.
Because I think I would have, especially if I was as young as Pandora would have been.
Mm-hmm. I think I would have. And I think, you know, Steno is, I'm an older sister. I don't know if you guys are where you are in the family hierarchy, but there, being an older sister or an older sibling, you do feel like this pressure to be a little more responsible, to do the right thing. So I relate to Steno a lot on the outside, but internally, I really relate to Eurylee. Like, she's a little bit more messy and complicated, and she has ugly thoughts that I've had as well. So yeah, I'd open the box.
But do you think that's because Steno has stopped herself from having those thoughts? Not that she hasn't had them, but she hasn't allowed herself to go down that route. Whereas Eurylee, she's like, well, no one's looking out for me, so I can do what I want.
I definitely think so. I think that throughout the story, Steno meets other people that are constantly pushing back at her, like, who are you? Who are you? You know, and it takes her a long time to answer the question.
Eurylee was my favorite, and I don't know what that says about me. Probably nothing good.
I love that. I was terrified that people were going to hate her. And I know you're not supposed to read your reviews, and this is when I stopped reading them. Someone on Goodreads had said, I hated Eurylee so much, I didn't read any of her chapters. And then gave the book 3 stars. And I'm like, well, you can't give it 3 stars. You only read half the book. You know, like you can't just skip every Riley chapter. I love her too.
I mean, she's a dick, but I'm kind of a dick as well. So, and
all are.
I think when the fact that Senno doesn't have these ugly thoughts, to me, she felt a little bit too perfect. And I completely get why she's like that as the older sister looking out for Medusa. But I kind of like the fact that Riley is just messy and a bit of a dick, and she kind of just owns it. And I like that about her.
Yeah, and definitely between the two of them, they find forgiveness and acceptance of each other, but they also never say they're sorry. And I think that's so much a part of family, or
even I noticed that. Yeah, I noticed they really never actually said it.
Yeah, it's just at some point you just kind of move on. And this is probably for the spoiler section, but it's Orion that really helps them find some kind of communion again after what happens with Medusa.
I'm going to go into a myth now that I thought was really cool that you included, because I don't think I've seen it in any of the many retellings that we've read, and that is Semele. As we go to Thebes with the sisters and we meet the start of the House of Cadmus, which as mythology nerds we know that's just a whole load of badness, but there's a necklace that we see and you don't know what it is, although we do know what it is. Semele puts it on Medusa, but Steno doesn't like it. She wants her to take it off. So what do you think it was about the necklace? Did she just get vibes that she didn't like?
Mm-hmm. I think she did. I think she's very intuitive. And I think she feels something dark about that necklace. Maybe because of its provenance, like how it was made and what it was made for, just didn't sit right with any of them. I loved writing Semele. And the reason I put her into the story is I did extensive research on the Gorgons. And at the end of the day, there's very little about either of them, right? Up until Athena's temple in Athens. So I had to create a story to get them to Athens at a time that is like really early in the chronology of Greek mythology. Like Perseus is the great, 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 great grandfather of Heracles, right? So we're like the very beginning. When they go to Athens, this is going to be pre-Pericles Athens, like way before the golden age of Athens. There's no Parthenon yet. So I really dug into what the other early myths were and how that could possibly overlap with the Gorgon's journey. Plus, I love that Semele is such a warning, like a foreshadowing for them that they blatantly ignore and what happens to her.
And you mentioned some things a bit later on in the book, but this isn't spoilery, so it's fine. But things that can be used to help with unwanted pregnancy. So did you do research for those?
I sure did. And I wanted it, you know, when I was writing the brothel scenes, I wanted that to feel real. And, you know, one of my favorite characters is actually the brothel master, who's also kind of a dick, right? The mistress there. And she talks a lot about how women need to have a choice. So that was very intentional on my part, because the Gorgons, they're kind of naive, really, when they enter human world. They're like country bumpkins a little bit, kind of stumbling around. And it's these human women who are really teaching them the harsh reality of human life and what it's like. Like when they're in Athens, I really wanted to play with the human influences that each sister has and the similarities and differences. So it's like Medusa, she meets these priestesses, right? And then Steno has Lygia, the musician. And then Euryale has Charmian, the brothel owner. And these are three ways that women could carve some space for themselves in the ancient world and have some kind of, you know, power and agency. And there's a lot of similarities between them.
I didn't take her as being a bit of a dick. I took her as someone who's, she's been around. She's got the measure of people. She can read people quite well. And she's very protective of the the girls in her care, because realistically they're not women yet, they're actually still quite young.
Oh, good. I'm glad you didn't think she's too much of a dick then. I mean, Lygia can be kind of a dick too. Like, she's a tough character. And I think, you know, a lot of these women are frustrated, right, by their lack of agency in the system. And I think that's why women in antiquity are getting so much time in the literary spotlight right now. It's because they face like a particular predicament where their lives were so controlled by men, and then the records of those lives were also controlled by men. So they kind of disappear unless we reimagine them and bring them back. And that's something that I get really excited about, that we're doing not just for our oral tradition, our stories, but for our real history as well.
And just going back to the contraception, I think it's so refreshing, and this just isn't just your book, it's coming through a lot in literature now, that we're seeing more of what are considered, using quotes, like women's problems. Like in your book, you have the contraception, you have the birth scene, obviously we have the temple scene, and it's allowing people to talk about them. Like, contraception shouldn't be this hush-hush thing. And you might not talk about it, but if it's in a book, I feel like it makes it easier to talk about it. And then you think about how it reflects on you.
And you also realize that forms of contraception are thousands of years old. This is not like a new thing. Like, women have been trying for ages to control their bodies and have some, you know, control over the trajectory of where they're going.
I love Typhon as kind of an idea. Like, monsters are my jam, and Greek mythology has some really, really cool ones. And what I find really interesting is the fact that you're so deliberate to tell us that Typhon was a good husband. He's someone who's done kind of power crazy things with going up against Zeus, but he's a good husband to his wife, and he loves his wife, Echidna. Did you do that to kind of contrast to the stories that we already know going into the book, and also things that we see that show us that Zeus and Poseidon are really bad husbands?
They are. They're horrible. But I also thought it would be a boring story if all the male characters are horrible. You know, that because that's not authentic either. So I wanted there to be counterexamples of like positive masculinity, you know, because there's a lot of toxic masculinity, especially with Poseidon, right? I felt like Erastus was kind of my sweetheart in this story, you know, who he's so supportive of his wife's career. And in his way, he's trying to get her work out to the world in the way that he can. I think their marriage is a really good example of like a mutual partnership, that it's not always just, you know, men dominating women.
This is the part of the episode where we discuss plot points and spoilers with Lauren. Listening past here won't turn you into stone, but it might spoil the story for you. So we suggest you come back and finish listening when you finish the book.
I wanted to hold off asking this pre-spoiler, but I feel like we can get into it now. Going back a bit, Ceto's last message to Medusa, it seems so, I took it as quite cruel, almost. And she says to her that it's pathetic to die by a human's hand. And I mean, we all know that's what happens to Medusa going into the story. Is she being cruel, or is it a warning in maybe not a great way?
Both. I don't think Ceto knows how to be a mother without being cruel. She's an example of motherhood that Eurylee actively seeks to contrast later in the book. Everything that Ceto did, Eurylee wants to do the opposite of. And I think what I wanted to do is it's almost sad, it's almost somber, because this is like the age of the monsters, and they still think that humans are so pathetic and so like worthless, not knowing where history is going to go, and that the monsters will die out and the humans will take control. So it's kind of almost bittersweet too.
But is it also us trying to put human emotion onto a monster?
That's an excellent point. And sometimes I think about that with Poseidon and Zeus, and in no way am I excusing their behavior, but also we do project like our own moral code onto characters that are not human, right? And they don't follow any of our, you know, morality. They're very much like, I want this, I take this. And obviously I chose to show that the goddesses are just as guilty of this behavior as well.
I guess that's what makes the demigods quite interesting, because they're in a weird place. They've got the god influence where they kind of do what they want and don't really care. But there's also a much more human side to them. And like looking at Perseus, he goes and he kills her for not really very much, but also for a lot, because his human side is what makes him have to do it to save his mum. Although in your story, he doesn't know that. But also, if he didn't have the god influence, maybe he wouldn't have felt compelled to just be like, yeah, I'll go off and kill this thing. Why not in the first place?
Or he wouldn't have had this divine intervention. Would Athena and Hermes have come down to save him if he wasn't, you know, Zeus's child? And yeah, there is that huge influence. I think in the book, I really wanted to critique just systems of power where there is a power system of a like very small minority that's allowed to act in any way they want with total impunity. Like nothing ever happens to them. And so, yes, that's Zeus and Poseidon, but that's also Athena and Hera.
Well, do you think that's the difference between the gods and the demigods? So they act in certain ways and it doesn't really affect them in any way. But the demigods, the way they act and their actions and what they do, they are left with the consequences.
For sure. I love how you put that. And I think that, you know, for Steno and Euryale, for example, they don't have any special powers when they're born. They're immortal, but there's nothing interesting about them. And they don't know where they belong. They don't belong with Echidna and the dragons and these really dope monsters. And then they try to belong in the human world, and it's catastrophic for them. And I hope that that's also something relatable to readers, is that trying to figure out where you belong is not an easy path for a lot of people.
To go back to the pregnancy, not that we're obsessed with this, but my notes say, I like that this story included Medusa's pregnancies, because others seem to take the approach of, oh, and yeah, she was pregnant at the time. And it just seemed like another element of she knew this was happening and how it affected her and her sister's relationships, rather than Perseus kills her, oh, and by the way, she happened to be pregnant.
And like, and monsters jump out of her neck. No, I think she's pregnant, you know, by a rape, and she does not want this pregnancy. And, you know, Steno is terrified and doesn't know what to do and is naive. And, you know, she says, if I had known more then, I would have helped her, but I didn't know what to do. And Euryale has the wildest reaction, because she's mad at her sister for being pregnant with the guy she loves, baby, right? But that's also Euryale, and that's her truth.
We spoke a bit earlier about the three sisters interacting with different humans when they go to Athens. And Medusa becomes very involved with Athena's temple. And during a special celebration for Athena, she actually meets her for the first time. And she makes what I thought was quite a bold statement to the hosts, where Ligeia says that she'd heard that Athena was awaiting a bigger temple, something in marble, which I assume is talking about the Parthenon, which comes later. And Medusa says, well, that doesn't sound like her. Is she naive here by thinking that she knows Athena really, really well? Or do you think, especially with the gift of hindsight, it's actually quite dangerous and misguided to think that you can know an Olympian on that deep of a level, especially when she's probably only met her once or like over a short time?
Oh, I think you absolutely nailed that interpretation of Medusa. I think Medusa is super idealistic. And Steno interprets it as being charming and kind of darling and kind of childlike about Medusa. And it drives Eurylee crazy. She thinks it's annoying. She thinks it's a facade. You know, she doesn't like any parts of that in Medusa. But Medusa does that a little bit with Semele too. She kind of romanticizes the people that she's obsessed with.
And do you think that comes about more with Medusa because she's the mortal one of the three sisters, whereas the other two are maybe a little bit more realistic about people, even if they make mistakes?
And I think, I'm sure you guys have seen this just in, you know, normal human situations, is like sometimes the child or the sibling in the family that's babied is a little overindulged, right? I think Medusa can't see, like, she knows she's going to die, but she's also lived a very like rosy life, a very protected and sheltered life. I think, you know, Steno always makes her feel special. So she doesn't have the same like self-protection that she should have.
The sisters, as you mentioned, they live with and integrate with human society. Why did you pick the locations you did, or did you pick the characters and then the locations to fit the characters?
I picked Thebes because I felt like, you guys touched on this already, like Thebes was such a hot spot at the beginning of, you know, the mythological record. So it would be fun to put them there. And I love Harmonia. I love Dionysus. I just love all of that. So it was fun to kind of put them in. And then I also knew the Sphinx would be at Thebes, which is Echidna's child. So I thought it would be fun if, you know, they kind of had that brush with one of Echidna's offspring. And then I knew they had to end up in Athens because of what was going to happen with Athena and Poseidon and Medusa. So that part of the story in Athens is where I tried to really keep with what I had read in the primary sources. Of course, I interpreted it differently. But yes, there's an assault by Poseidon in Athena's temple.
And in Athens, one of the characters that the sisters meet is Ligeia, who is a composer, and Steno asks for music lessons from her. And in one of these lessons, Ligeia is composing a song. She asks her to close her eyes and listen. And she asks what colours she sees. And I really liked, again, as someone who plays music, I really liked this touch of synesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like it was a moment that, other than just being geeky and being like, oh, I know what that is, I really felt it was a moment of someone trying to encourage her to let go and not be the sister that's always protecting and have something for herself and actually just stop and listen. Was that your intention? I don't know. That's what I took from it.
Yes, and to be creative. I think in a situation like that, there's no right or wrong answer. And Steno's very concerned with things that have right or wrong answers. You know, she's a very black and white character for a lot of the book. And music, like when she's obsessed with, well, what does the song mean? I have to know what it means. And Ligeia's like, well, what it means to me is different than what it's going to mean to you. We have different life experiences. We're coming at it differently. You know, that's really hard for Steno to understand.
I liked that you mentioned that things mean different things to different people because of life experience. I thought that was really cool.
Thank you.
I feel like I've got a lot of questions about sex coming up now. I'm not sex obsessed, I promise. Oh, we're not sex obsessed. Between us, we have a few. But Eurylee, she is so obsessed with the idea of having sex with Poseidon. There's a point earlier where she says that she acknowledges that Semele has sort of got what she wanted on her back rather than on her knees. And Eurylee even goes to the brothel to watch the, Hetari? Is that how you pronounce it? Maybe.
So many of these words I learned by reading, not by hearing. So I am also not the best at pronouncing them. It's been a struggle for me as well.
Okay, so a higher class escort. So let's say that. She goes and she watches them to get pointers. Why is she so obsessed with him? Apart from the fact that she thinks that he's hot. I can't get anything else.
And is it specifically him, or is it the fact that she just wants to have sex with someone? She wants a connection.
He is an Olympian, which she is obsessed with, right? She's very into hierarchy. She loves that he is at the top, you know, of the social echelon. He's also, when she is this kind of country bumpkin and they're at Pandora's wedding and they're such outcasts there, he makes her feel really desirable. And that has a profound effect on her because it's the first time she feels first as like she feels individual, but she feels very seen. And she becomes very obsessed with him. And when Semele talks about like, oh, Zeus says I'm the best he's ever had, that clicks something in Eurylee because she didn't think of sex like that. I think she thought of it more as an, you know, like animals, right? So then she realizes there's even more pressure. I have to also be very good at it and I have to know what I'm doing. And yeah, he becomes kind of her defining mission is to try and get him.
I don't believe that Semele is the best that Zeus has ever had. That was a line. I'm sorry. She was probably a virgin when he first slept with her. That was a line.
Yeah, you know Hera knows what she's doing.
It's a line.
We read this and you're almost like cringing for these girls. Like, you guys, you're so naive. Like, you know, it's that moment when you're watching a Shakespeare play and the audience is freaking out because they can see what's going to happen and they know, but they can't say anything. But to be honest, I look back at younger Lauren and I see those moments in my own history and I cringe and I, you know, I wish I could yell to her. So maybe I was working through some of my own stuff here.
But then you only know that now because you've gone through it. Had you not gone through it, you wouldn't have that reaction. So I think it is normal for someone to be like, oh, but he said this. And obviously Zeus is saying he's a flatterer. He wants to get what he wants. Mm-hmm. He knows how to get what he wants or take it.
And so much of what Eurylee learns is that it's about power, right? And she realizes how to take her power back with Poseidon is the second she realizes, like, I don't love you like that anymore. And that's when he flips and he wants that back. He wants that worship back because he's an Olympian and he thrives off of worship and devotion and sacrifice. So she learns how to manipulate him in the end and get what she wants, which, you know, we were talking earlier about the disconnect between what a character wants and what they need. Eurylee thinks she wants Poseidon, right? And his love. Or this love with him. But what Eurylee needs is to give unconditional love. And she gets that with Orion. So getting her son is what actually like emotionally fulfills her, is that opportunity to finally just love something purely.
I like that she didn't have sex with him straight away. And she that she did learn. She kind of learned how to play the game a little bit.
So I don't know. I'm mad that she did it in the end, but obviously then she needed to get Orion, but
yeah,
I was she mad wanted... at her at that point.
I know. It's so relatable. Of course, it's unforgivable. I mean, Steno basically like calls her a whore, right? Like, but what Eurylee really, really wants is to be a mother. And at that point, she feels with her transformation that she is disfigured. She doesn't see a way for her to like get pregnant and become a mother in any other way if it's not with Poseidon.
Eurylee sees Medusa in having sex with someone, and at the time we don't know who it is. Why do you think this annoys her so much? Is it because Medusa has something that she doesn't?
Because it's once again, Medusa seems to, I think Eurylee feels, and this is, I think, a sisterly feeling, that Medusa just gets everything and everything comes really easy to Medusa, and Medusa gets her Olympian. And I also think that Eurylee knows that this is a wild situation, that Athena is known as a virgin goddess, and that this is going to be, this is salacious, right? And I did read a lot about homosexuality in ancient Greece, and from what I read, it was accepted amongst men, but not accepted amongst women, which is not shocking to any of us, right? So it would have been like not alarming, but it would have been, you know, wild for her to see.
Well, I did hear that Queen Victoria just didn't believe that women had sex with each other, and that's why lesbianism wasn't ever outlawed.
Oh, that's really funny. I didn't know that.
I don't know how true it is, but it makes me laugh.
No, like, I've had the same.
There's an, I think it's Ovid, a quote from him, and it's like, mares do not lust over other mares. Like, it was just thought to be like scientifically, naturally impossible. Meanwhile, all these men are paying for, you know, little boys to be with them. So it's just another example in the long history of double standards and hypocrisy.
Going back to Poseidon, Eurylee has a conversation with Poseidon. And I was really interested by this point. So he gives her a pearl. He actually gives her an oyster and she opens it and it's a pearl inside. But afterwards, she can't find it. So was the pearl a mirage to kind of turn her head and make her think things about Poseidon?
I think so. I think what I was trying to imply is that so much of him is a mirage. You know, everything about him and the way he talks to her and the things he kind of hints at or promises her is a false pearl. You know, it's fake. Yeah. Poor thing.
I know, poor thing. But I do get annoyed at her in the end, but you do think, you know, you see her fall for this guy and she wants someone to love her in a way that she feels Steno loves Medusa. And that's what she's craving. And it is sad because he's just doing all this trickery. But they have a conversation. So Eurylee is talking to Poseidon and she tells him what she's seen. And that kind of puts the events in motion leading up to Medusa's rape and the curse of the sisters. So Eurylee, as we've mentioned, she'd seen Medusa and Athena together. So Poseidon attacks Medusa to get back at Athena for winning Athens. And Athena then takes this as Medusa has been gossiping about them and she loses it and, you know, curses her. And then when her sisters try and intervene, curses them. But it seems like such a petty reason to commit this act against Medusa from Poseidon's, because he holds on to this to the point where he's like, right, aha, I'm going to get Athena's favorite. And it's like you said, it's quite a detailed account of what happens to Medusa, and it's quite a violent thing to do because a city named Athena, their god.
I think, you know, the way that the gods approach life or approach the other figures in their lives is very transactional. And that's what's so painful, is that this, like, absolutely cataclysmic event to Medusa and to her family is really just another transaction in the power dynamics of these gods, of these people in power. And yeah, I think that's the core of the heartbreak.
Like, even to the point where he pushes her down when he's done. Like, it just, oh, you didn't skimp from the details there.
I didn't. I think that, like I said earlier, if I had closed the door and didn't face what happened to Medusa, it felt like I was only doing Poseidon a favor. Like it felt like, then maybe what he did could be excusable, or maybe it could be interpreted differently, or maybe you could visualize it as like a little less bad. But when you have to face it, when you have to see it, then you have to confront the reality of what happens to women all the time. And I was also really intentional. That scene was obviously so hard to write, but I also wanted to write from the perspective of a woman walking in to see, her best friend, her sister, the person she loves most, being treated in such a way, because I know what that's like to have women I love come tell me those stories or explain what happened to them. And I really wanted to capture the horror of watching this happen and not being able to stop it, or not being able to take it back for someone you love or fix it. Does that make sense?
I think you've done it really well. And for me, it was that last bit, the bit where he kind of just tosses her aside, almost like she didn't actually matter in this. This act wasn't about Medusa.
Not at all. He had no interest in her.
She could have been anyone.
She could have been anyone. It was purely between him and Athena.
And after all of this, Euryale still wants to have sex with him.
I know.
Why?
I mean, when Steno and Euryale walk in on them, it's wild. The discrepancy in their reactions. Steno is like, "How is this happening to my sister?" And Euryale is like, "How could he do this to me?" It's two very different reactions. And to be honest, all of this came because when I was doing all this research and researching kind of more obscure characters in Greek mythology, it's like you get all these pieces, but they're like pieces to a different puzzle, so you can't put them together nicely. But the one piece I found that rocked my world, that totally changed the trajectory of the novel, was when I saw Euryale as the mother of Orion with Poseidon. And when I saw that, and I thought, wait, one of the sisters has a baby with the guy who raped her sister? Like, this is worse than any reality show, soap opera, like I've ever seen. But I also knew it would make one hell of a story.
I have a couple of thoughts about this, but do you think Euryale regrets telling him? I mean, obviously, she didn't know the full extent of what would happen and that her and Steno would be punished as well. But the fact that for a long time she's kind of jealous that Medusa got her man, even though Medusa didn't want it and Poseidon is not her man. Do you think, or especially at first, she regrets telling him more because
Of what
Medusa,
happened.
yeah, because Medusa got her man?
I think the natural reaction would be yes, of course she's going to regret it. But at the same time, I don't think Euryale regrets anything she does. Like, I just don't think she's that kind of person. So I don't know. That's kind of up for debate.
Because she seemed more jealous than concerned.
Yeah. I think that, and because she wants to be pregnant so badly and she wants to be a mother, and then to see Medusa be pregnant and not even want it really gets Euryale's goat, right? Like, when it's everything she ever wanted, and Medusa already had Athena, and then she gets a second Olympian. And so, yeah, for Euryale, she just thinks all of this is so unfair.
Obviously, Athena takes her anger out on Medusa. So, in your opinion, why couldn't she have left it there? Why do you think, when time has passed, she helps Perseus to kill Medusa?
I think that the way Athena treats Medusa after the rape is very reminiscent of how we treat rape victims, right? Is like, maybe this was kind of your fault and you're a little bit dirty now. And, you know, it's this really cruel, cold flippancy. And it's so unfair, right? But then I think really what condemns them the most is when Steno tries to stand up for her sister and threatens to tell everyone what Athena has done. And Athena is so afraid for her own reputation. She's so afraid to be outed that, yeah, she goes to great lengths to stop them in whatever way she can.
But she keeps some of Medusa's hair, doesn't she? She like wears it around her wrist, which I thought was a nice touch.
Thank you.
So after the girls are cursed, they go into a kind of self-imposed exile because they realise that actually they could turn men to stone. So that's after they've been cursed, but before Perseus visits them, they have a visit from Leto.
Mm-hmm.
What is the significance of Leto asking to hear Medusa's story in her own words? Because she was also raped by an Olympian, raped by one Olympian, and punished by another.
Yes. And, you know, this is another example of a positive mother figure that I wanted to bring in for before Eurylee would get, you know, would have Orion. I think Leto is lovely. And I really appreciated an opportunity for women who have experienced the same trauma to be able to speak openly with each other. And I think Medusa really needed that because neither of her sisters, even though they loved her, especially Steno, but Steno doesn't understand what Medusa went through like Leto does. And I think it's like one of the first steps in Medusa's kind of healing process. And for, you know, we were talking about like the sanitized version of these myths. It's like when we're little and we hear the stories and we're like, oh, and then Poseidon and so-and-so had a baby together. Well, no, tell me what really happened. You know, this is what really happened.
What I thought was interesting as well, when Leto's talking to her, is when Medusa asks her, did you ever hate them? Talking about the twins. And Leto says, oh, I've never been asked that. And it's almost nice for Medusa to be able to ask that question of someone who has been through what she's been through. Obviously, Medusa doesn't want to be pregnant. So to be able to share maybe the unsaid things with someone who can understand.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's even when you want your child, motherhood can be a really complicated experience. And you sometimes have ugly thoughts. And I think that literature is such an opportunity. I said earlier for compassion, but also for catharsis, right? And like that really goes back to ancient Greece and ancient Greek drama and tragedy. But it's almost like an opportunity to work through some of your own emotions.
I've heard people say that you can love your children and still be kind of resentful of them, even though you want them and you love them more than anything.
Mm-hmm. That's very true.
What made you choose to have the sisters decorate Athena's, and I'm probably going to butcher this, Aegis, but the mm-hmm. shield?
One of the plot problems for the story was I knew my readers are going to want some kind of revenge or justice or vengeance on Poseidon and Athena. But it's very hard in this system of this ancient Greek world and this strict hierarchy and the way the power is divided to get justice against those who've wronged you, especially if they're at the top of the food chain, right? So I had to create new ways that they could get back at Poseidon and Athena. And then when there was this, maybe this opportunity to bring Semele back, who I had loved writing about at the beginning of the book, and she can help throw this wild party and steal the shield so the sisters can basically vandalize it, right? They graffiti it in their virgin blood, which, you know, I just made up, but that is so pure and true that it can't be removed. And just to be like a reminder to Athena of what she did to the woman she loved and that who loved her.
I liked it as, I thought it was a really cool decision, because in artwork that you see of Athena, both from then and now, she has a Gorgon head on her shield. And so for you to twist it and make it something that was a punishment towards her, I thought was really, really clever. So
thank you. Props
for that.
Thank you. And then I think with Poseidon, you know, finally Euryale turns him down and he realizes he has no power over her. And then Steno gets to come into this little secret cove and just kind of tell him what she's wanted to tell him forever. Is her, you know, her moment to say what she wanted to say.
She could have gone harder. She should have said, yeah. Actually, and your dick is quite small and you didn't make me come.
Yeah.
And your beard's a bit rubbish and you smell like fish. I would have gone harder. So I'm impressed by her restraints. She was a lot more classy with it than I would have been.
Yeah, she was very lyrical about it, right?
In the world that you created, where are the two sisters now? Or after the book ends?
You know, so Euryale is at peace in the ocean. That's where I see her. And Steno, in my original first draft, I had it her even going into the Trojan War, her like kind of intervening with like the Amazons, and like I saw this whole adventure for her with her abilities. You know, she has these wings, she has this cool snake power, she can turn men to stone. But overall, I thought the ending with her going off into the unknown, embracing adventure on her own for the first time, was enough of an ending. But I see her doing all kinds of stuff.
Medusa says in your book that she wants to be remembered for what she did, what she said, and who she loved, rather than how she died. So what do you think that she would think about the legacy she has for people today, based on the character, the way you've written her? So what would your Medusa think about her legacy as we see her now in 2023?
Oh, I think she would hate it, because my Medusa is so different. Like I was saying earlier, she's not the like sexy male, you know, created image of, she's not Britney Spears at the VMAs, and she wasn't full of like vengeance and rage and anger. So I don't think she would like how she's been manipulated in that way. But I think with all the new Medusa stories that are coming out, she would appreciate the curiosity that goes into telling her stories, because that's so much a part of the Medusa I created, you know, and about learning and about exploring and about asking good questions and being kind.
I've got one more question, because we were discussing this earlier. The Hatairi, there is a ex-priestess who is mute. Mm-hmm. I've got a theory. Lauren wanted to know what happened so that her tongue was cut out.
What do you guys think?
I think she was either sexually assaulted or rejected someone's advances, and either way got punished for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that because of every story we know with a woman whose tongue has been cut out, it's because she was either sexually assaulted or rejected someone's advances.
Mm-hmm. And I think that the culprit here is Athena. So I really, it's so funny because when I was little, Athena was my favorite goddess. And so there's some like weird childhood trauma I'm working through where, you know, like you kill your heroes as you get older, because I really turned her into something horrible with this story.
So she kind of is.
Yeah, I think that's it. Is when I was younger, I loved that she was wisdom and war. That seemed really cool and really empowering. But then as an older woman reading through the stories, I'm like, actually, the way she acts is super problematic and not very supportive of women. So, yeah, I didn't let her just like skate by.
I don't know, right? Because we've mentioned this before. We've talked to other people about Athena, and I just, you can still be a feminist and be a dickhead. Like, yeah, and I mean, that was the reaction that we got last time I said that. But I think there's so much emphasis on being a feminist and being nice to everybody. Now, she is problematic. I'm not saying that she isn't at all, and that she's not, I'm not advocating for or justifying any of her behavior. But I find it weird that we've got to a place where you can only really be a feminist if you're nice to everybody. But actually, right, she still is wisdom and war and strategy and all of these things that women wouldn't have been able to do back in the ancient world. She's just also a bit of an arsehole.
Right. And also what she's doing is no different than what all the other Olympians are doing, right? Like, she's just participating in the system of power that exists. So kind of the same thing we were saying about Zeus and Poseidon, like, we can judge them with our own human moral code. But that's not how they operate. It's the same thing with Athena. She's no different.
She's definitely not a girl's girl.
No,
but she's also not in a girl's world.
I think she's drunk the patriarchy Kool-Aid a little bit. Like, she's had a sip. She's had a sip, at least.
Mm-hmm. She's emulating the behaviors that she sees, right, in her father and her uncles.
But then, you know, Aphrodite's a girl's girl. She's also a bit of an arsehole. Hestia is a girl's girl, and we don't even talk about her.
Nope. We got nothing.
We've got no stories about Hestia, and she's meant to be the one who, you know, the whole hearth was built around.
Mm-hmm. Excellent points.
Well, thank you so much for coming to talk to us today. We've really enjoyed it. Do you have any exciting projects coming up?
I do. I am in revisions right now for my second novel. It's coming out next summer, Mother of Rome. So it's the story of Rhea Silvia, the mythical mother of Romulus and Remus. And it's cool because it's ancient Rome, but it's Rome before it's Rome, when it's really just a loose confederation of Latin tribes. And she's a Vestal virgin. She gets pregnant. There's a god. I think people are going to like her. I hope so. I like her.
I like the fact that it's different to what other people are doing. She's not someone that we've seen retellings for, so I'm excited.
And it was nice to kind of move out of the Greek space for a little bit and go examine how another civilization treated their pantheon. And it's very different than the Greeks, because with the ancient Romans, it was more like, we worship you, we do our devotions, and then you kind of like leave us alone a little bit, not like the Greeks where they're all up in each other's business. So yeah, it's different. It's fun.
Where can people find you online to support you, follow you, hear more updates about release dates and covers and spoilers and everything? Teasers, not spoilers, teasers.
I'm most active on Instagram, probably. I'm just at Lauren J. Hebert. That's my Twitter or X. I don't know how I'm supposed to reference that anymore. And then I have a TikTok, author Lauren J. Hebert, but I like barely use it. I'm still trying to figure it out.
Well, we will put links to that in our episode description so that people can find you super easily.
It was such a treat to talk to two like absolute experts in this field. And no, it was
I
so
wouldn't go
fun.
that. We're not experts.
But like I can name drop Cadmus and you guys are like, oh yeah, we're on a first name basis as well. Like we're all on this in this same weird world, nerdy world together.
Thanks for hanging out with us today, and again, special thanks to Lauren. Follow us on Instagram, Demythifying the Podcast, to learn more about episodes that you can find on Spotify, Audible, Apple Podcasts, and more. And if you're liking what we're doing, please rate us and subscribe. Also, check out our website, www.demythpod.co.uk. She's been Charlotte. I've been Lauren. And today, we've been turning pages with Lauren J.A. Bear.